Right, today we're going to talk about two topics. The first part of today's lecture will be devoted to balanced binary search trees. And then in the second part, we'll begin to talk about the data structure graph. Okay. All right, so let's start with balanced binary search trees. Now, as we know from our previous lecture, a binary search tree itself could have a height that ranges as far as order of log n. And of course, the smallest height, the height of a binary search tree can range from a low of log n to a max of order of n. Okay. Now, that's not too good as far as allowing us to perform search, insert, and removes in logarithmic time. And so we want to take a look at a restricted class of binary trees whose height actually is log n, and also one which allows us to perform the dictionary operations search, insert, and remove in logarithmic time. Okay. Now, so as I said, the height of a balanced binary search tree is going to be order of log n, n being the number of elements in the tree. And we're going to take a look at two of the more popular versions of balanced binary search trees. The first tree we're going to look at is called an AVL tree, named after its inventors, Adelson, Valesky, and Landis. The other one we're going to take a look at is called red-black trees. And each of these varieties of binary search trees will allow us to perform get, put, and remove operations in logarithmic time each. Now, these aren't the only types of balanced search trees that are out there. There are actually a large variety of search trees, and I'll go through the names of some of these in a moment. But let's turn our attention for a moment to performing the indexed operations that we mentioned. You want to get an element given its index, and you want to remove an element given its index. Well, these operations can also be done in logarithmic time using balanced binary search trees, so long as we use indexed versions of these search trees. So in an indexed version of a search tree, recall, all we do is we add another field to each node, and this field keeps track of the number of nodes in the left subtree of that particular node. Okay, so we have a left size field. All right, so the indexed varieties are called indexed AVL trees and indexed red-black trees. And these allow us to perform the indexed operations, get by index, remove by index, in logarithmic time, in addition to the normal binary search tree operations, get, put, remove, in logarithmic time. Okay. All right, now, as I'd mentioned a little while ago, there actually is a rather large variety of search trees around, not necessarily binary. And on this slide here, I have listed some of them. So there are things called weight-balanced binary search trees, 2-3 and 2-3-4 trees. These ones aren't binary trees. There are AA trees, which are binary trees. There are B trees, which, except for orders 3 and 4, there are B trees, and these also are not binary trees. There are BBST trees, which are binary trees. So in this set of five balanced trees that I've mentioned, the AA tree and the weight-balanced binary trees and the BBSTs would be examples of binary search trees. The 2-3, 2-3-4, and B trees, these would not be examples of binary search trees, but still they're balanced search trees which permit dictionary operations in logarithmic time. Okay. All right, we aren't going to look at these varieties in this class at all. All right, so let's take a look at the first of the two binary search trees I want to talk about today, namely the AVL tree. As the name would suggest, binary search tree, it is a binary tree. Okay. And for every node in that binary tree, we will define something called its balance factor, which is the height of the left subtree of the node. Okay, so you look at a node X, and you take the height of the left subtree of X, and from that you subtract the height of the right subtree of X, and that gives us the balance factor of the node X. Okay. Now, I should mention here that in some books, the balance factor is defined slightly different. Instead of taking the height of left minus the height of right, they define the balance factor to be the height of the right subtree minus the height of the left. Okay. But in this class, we're going to do it the way it's here, height of left subtree minus height of right subtree. Now, the requirement is that the balance factor of every node in an AVL tree needs to be either minus 1, 0, or plus 1. Okay. All right, so to be an AVL tree, we have two requirements. One is you must be a binary tree, and second, the balance factor of every node in that binary tree needs to be minus 1, 0, or plus 1. Let's take a look at an example. Okay, if you look at this binary tree here, we may compute the balance factors of the nodes. So beginning with this node down here, the left subtree and right subtree each have a height that is 0, so the height difference is 0. Moving on to the next node here, the height difference between these two subtrees is also 0. And then if we move on up here, the left subtree has a height that is 1. The right subtree also has a height that's 1. The height difference is 0. Over here, the two subtrees each have a height that's 0, so the difference is 0. Okay. And over here, the left subtree has a height that is 2. The height of the right subtree is 1, so the height difference is 1. And now moving over to this side, the balance factor there is 0. For the parent node, the balance factor is minus 1. The height of the left subtree is 0, whereas that of the right subtree is 1. The balance factor here is 0. Then over here, left subtree has a height that is 2, the subtree here. The right subtree has a height that is 1, so the difference is 1. The balance factor there is 0. Here it is minus 1. And over here, the balance factor is 1. Then moving up to the overall root, the height of the left subtree is 3, and the height of the right subtree is 1, 2, 3, 4, so the height difference is minus 1. Okay. All right, so this example tree is an AVL tree. Now, to get an example of a binary tree that is not an AVL tree, we could simply add a child down here. If you added a child here, then the balance factor of this node would become minus 2, because the height of the left subtree would be 0, and the height of the right subtree would then be 2 once you add a node over here. Okay. All right, so some binary trees are AVL trees, others are not AVL trees. What one can prove, and it's proved in the text, is that the height of an AVL tree that has n nodes is at most 1.44 log of n plus 2. Okay. Also, we know that an n-node binary tree cannot have a height that is smaller than log n plus 1. This follows from the fact that a full binary tree has an exponential number of nodes in it. Okay. So from these two things, we see that the height of an AVL tree lies between log of n plus 1 and 1.44 log of n plus 2. All right, so AVL trees have the desired property, the height is order of log n. Now, an AVL search tree is simply an AVL tree that is also a binary search tree. Okay. So here's the same binary tree we had before, and I've just placed keys in there to satisfy the search tree requirements. Now, as far as searching an AVL search tree is concerned, incidentally, most of the time when we're going to talk about AVL search trees, we'll just drop the term search from there, and we'll understand an AVL tree to be an AVL search tree. All right, so suppose you want to perform the search operation, you want to look for something in here. It's no different from searching any other binary search tree. Okay, so the fact that it's AVL doesn't help you in the search. You just proceed as you did before. If you are looking for a 25, it's bigger than 10, you'll come here. It's smaller than 40, you'll come here. It's smaller than 30, you'll come there. Bigger than 20, it's over here, and you find it. Okay. The only difference that has happened is that the complexity of the search is no longer order of n as it was for an unbalanced binary search tree. The complexity of the same search algorithm has dropped. It is now order of log n, because the height of an AVL search tree is order of log n. Okay. Right, turn our attention to the put operation. I'm not going to go through all of the details in the put. We just want to take a look at one case to give us a flavor for how put works. Okay. All right, so let's suppose you want to put the element 9. Okay, an element whose key is 9. Well, as before, we will search for the 9, so it's smaller than 10, bigger than 7, bigger than 8, you fall off here. That's where we'd like to put it. So let's go ahead and put it there. We get a node, we put in the element, and we set the pointer. And now we retrace the path from here backwards, resetting the balance factors as needed. Okay. So the balance factor of the red node is 0, it has no children. The balance factor of this node here, the height of the left subtree is 0, height of the right subtree is 1, so it becomes minus 1. Moving up here, the balance factor out here changes from 1 to 0. Okay. So when a balance factor changes to 0, we don't need to move any further up, because the change to 0 tells us that the height of that subtree did not change as a result of the put operation. And if the height of a subtree doesn't change, then balance factors further up the tree cannot change either. Okay. So in this case, we start at the red node, go back up the path we took on the way down, and change balance factors. Once you reach a node whose balance factor now becomes 0, then you don't need to go any further. Okay. All right, so this is the case where a put operation does not cause imbalance in the tree, by which I mean you start with an AVL tree, you do the put, and you're left with another AVL tree. Okay. Let's try a put operation which does cause imbalance. That is, you start with an AVL tree, you do the put, and you no longer have an AVL tree. All right, this happens when you try to do a put with a key of 29. Okay. This is where the new node has to go. You put in the 29, you set the pointer, and then you retrace the path from the new node, the red node, back toward the root, resetting or adjusting the balance factors. The balance factor of the newly inserted node is always 0. You go up here, the height of the right subtree of this node increased by 1, the height of the left subtree didn't, so the balance factor decreases by 1. So it becomes minus 1. Okay. All right, so now we go further up here. Again, the height of the right subtree increased by 1. The height of the left subtree didn't, so the balance factor decreases by 1, and it becomes minus 2. Okay. So the moment we reach a node whose balance factor becomes plus 2 or minus 2, we know that we no longer have an AVL tree. So this time, we need to perform some remedial operation, which will take our non-AVL tree and transform it into an AVL tree. Okay. To perform this remedial operation, we, of course, must first find the node whose balance factor becomes plus or minus 2, and we'll call this the blue node. Okay. So we find this as we move back up the path from the red node to the root. Okay. So once you find a blue node, then we'll characterize the kind of problem we have by looking at the first two moves needed from the blue node to reach the red node. Okay. The red node could be quite far from the blue one, but we're going to take a look at only the first two of the moves needed to go from the blue node to the red. In this case, to go from the blue node to the red, I need to make a right-right move. I need to go to the right child and then again to the right child. So I'll classify this as a write-write type of problem, a write-write imbalance, abbreviated as RR imbalance. Okay. All right, so in this case, I have an RR imbalance. Of course, so you could have many, you have other types of imbalances. If the first two moves were left and left, you'd have an LL. If the first two moves were go to the right child and then to the left, it would be an RL. And then, of course, you have one more case, the LR. Okay. Now, if you have an RR imbalance, a write-write imbalance, then the way we fix that imbalance is by performing a rotation around the blue node. And this rotation is a counterclockwise rotation in which the right child of the blue node occupies the position the blue node currently occupies. The right subtree of this fellow remains as the right subtree of this node. The blue node, together with its left subtree, if any, will become the left subtree of the 25. Recall now the 25 is sitting up there. And the other change will be that the left subtree of the 25 will move and occupy the position as the right subtree of the blue node. And all right, so to summarize, we'll basically perform a counterclockwise rotation around the blue node. And once you make that counterclockwise rotation, this is what happens. The right child of the blue node occupied the position previously occupied by the blue node. The blue node becomes the left child of this fellow. The right subtree, the former right subtree of the 25 remains as the right subtree of the 25. The former left subtree of the blue node remains as the left subtree of the blue node. The former left subtree of the 25 will become the right subtree of the blue node. Okay. And then you can verify that once you perform this transformation, you still have a binary search tree. All of the keys are properly placed. The other interesting thing about this rotation is that the rotation results in a subtree out here whose height is the same as the height of this subtree prior to the put operation. Okay, so the height down here stays the same. The new balance factor of this node becomes zero. And since the height of this subtree is unchanged from what it was before the put, you don't need to go any further up adjusting balance factors. All of those remain the same. Okay. All right, so basically, that's the RR rotation, a counterclockwise rotation around the blue node. Now, for the remaining types of imbalance, a left-left, a right-left, and a left-right, we can define similar rotations. And the text has all of the rotations in there. We aren't going to look at the rotations in any detail here. Now, as far as the course is concerned, you need to know AVL trees only to the extent we have discussed them so far. I will not be looking at the remove operation in class. The text has that. But as far as the course is concerned, you don't really need to know anything about the remove operation. Okay. All right. Let's turn our attention to the second variety of balanced binary search trees, the one called red-black trees. Here, we are only going to take a look at the definition of red-black trees. In fact, we will see two different definitions of red-black trees. And again, for purposes of this class, that's the extent to which you need to know what red-black trees are. You need to know the definition and what the height properties are. Okay. And that's all we're going to do today on red-black trees. Okay. All right. Now, in a red-black tree, you color either the nodes of the tree or you color the edges of the tree. And corresponding to which way you go, you end up with two different definitions. Okay. The first definition results from coloring the nodes, and that we'll call the colored nodes definition. Okay. All right, so a red-black tree, it's a binary search tree. Okay. Each node of the tree has a color associated with it. The color may be red, the color may be black. Okay. The requirements on coloring are The root node and all of the external nodes must be colored black. Again, here in the definition of a red-black tree, it is convenient to bring in external nodes. These are actually fictitious nodes. They aren't going to be present in any real implementation of a red-black tree. They're convenient from the definition point of view. Okay. All right, the other requirement on coloring is no root to external node path may have two consecutive red nodes. And then finally, all root to external node paths must have the same number of black nodes. Okay. All right, so a red-black tree using the colored nodes definition is a binary search tree. All the nodes are colored. The allowable colors are red and black. The root and the external nodes have to be colored black. No, you can't have two consecutive red nodes. And the number of black nodes on every root to external node path must be the same. Okay. Let's take a look at it, an example. Okay. All right, so here I have a binary search tree. I've put in the external nodes. These are these black square nodes at the bottom. Okay. Again, recall these nodes will actually not be present in any implementation. Rather, you'll have null pointers in their parents in place of a pointer to a black node as shown here. Okay. All right, so the square nodes are the external nodes. Okay. The root has to be colored black. The external nodes must all be black. Okay, so we satisfy that property. If you follow any path from the root to an external node, you should not run into two back-to-back red nodes. Okay, so we have black, 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 red, black. Okay. There's no restriction on having two consecutive black nodes, okay? So you can have, like here, we got three consecutive black nodes on the path. You can have as many consecutive black nodes as you like. You simply can't have two consecutive red nodes, okay? The other requirement was that if you count the number of black nodes on any root to external node path, you should have the same result, okay? So if we follow this one here, one, two, three, and the external node, that's four. So we've got four black nodes on that path. Pick some other one. One, two, three, four. Okay. Or one, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Okay. So it doesn't matter which root to external node path you follow, you will encounter exactly four black nodes. Okay. All right. So the colored binary search tree that we have here satisfies all of the requirements placed on the node definition of a red-black tree, and therefore it is a red-black tree. An alternative definition results when you color the edges of the red-black tree rather than the nodes of the red-black tree. Okay. As before, it's a binary search tree. The edges, namely the child pointers, left child and right child pointers in the tree, these are colored, and again, the allowable colors are red and black. Okay. The pointers to external nodes must be black. No root to external node path should have two consecutive red pointers. And every root to external node path must have the same number of black pointers. Right, so the constraints on the coloring are quite similar to what was placed before. Okay. Colors to external nodes must be black. Previously we said all external nodes must be colored black. Of course, we also had a requirement that the root be colored black, but the root doesn't have an edge coming into it, so there's no requirement on the edge coming into the root here. You can't have two consecutive red pointers. There it was, you couldn't have two consecutive red nodes. Every root to external node path must have the same number of black pointers. In there it was, you must have the same number of black nodes. Okay. All right, so it's basically the same set of constraints applied to edges rather than to nodes. Okay. Here's an example red-black tree. In this case, I have colored both the nodes and the edges. Okay. For a moment, look only at the colors on the edges, and you'll see that if you all the external nodes have black edges. Okay. There is no path that has two consecutive red edges. Okay, so if you look at this one here, which actually has two red edges, they aren't consecutive. There's a black edge in between. Okay. If you follow any root to external node path, the number of black edges should be the same. So you got one black edge, two black edges, and one down here, three. If you follow some other path, one, then a red edge, two, three. Okay. Now, actually, if you stare at this enough, you'll see that you can infer the node colors from the edge colors or vice versa. Okay. Every red node has a red edge coming into it. Every black node has a black edge coming into it. The root is the only node whose color may be in doubt, and for that we use a default which says the root must always be black. Okay. All right, you can prove that the height of a red-black tree must lie between log n and 2 times log n. So from the height standpoint, the bounds are not as good as for an AVL tree. An AVL tree's height cannot be more than 1.44 log n. Okay. But it turns out that most implementations of red-black trees actually run faster than implementations of AVL trees, even though the worst-case height of a red-black tree may be somewhat more than that of an AVL tree. Java has an implementation of a red-black tree in its class called TreeMap. Okay. So it looks like red-black trees actually do find sufficient application that they would be implemented as a standard data structure in a language such as Java. All right, so much for balanced binary search trees. Let's now turn our attention to the topic of graphs. This is a topic I expect all of you are familiar with from earlier courses, so you should regard today's discussion of graphs just as a review of material you already know. Okay. All right, essentially a graph is given by two sets, V and E. V is the set of vertices, and E is the set of edges. The vertex set could also be referred to as the node set or the point set. Members of the vertex set could be called vertices. Members could be called nodes. Members could be called points. The edge set is E, and edges have the property that they connect two different vertices. We'll also use the terms arcs and lines to refer to edges. Okay. All right, so a graph is given by two sets, a vertex set V and an edge set E. Each edge is required to connect two different vertices. In some cases, you may have a need for something that looks like a graph, except that you need to have edges that connect the same vertex to itself. In that case, we'll say that you have a graph with self loops. Okay. But the term graph itself doesn't allow you to have an edge that connects the same vertex to itself. Okay. We'll use this notation to denote an edge. We'll give the two vertices that are connected by the edge. Okay. So this edge here connects the vertex U and the vertex V. We'd have two types of edges, one called directed, the other called undirected. A directed edge has an orientation. So if UV represents a directed edge, then the edge begins at vertex U and connects to vertex V, and it'll be drawn in this fashion with an arrowhead on the connecting line. Okay. So this represents an edge that begins at U, goes to V. At times, we will refer to U as being the tail of the edge, and V as being the head of the edge. Okay. An undirected edge has no orientation. The same notation is used. Okay. And if we are going to draw it, it will be drawn in this fashion. You have a line connecting the two vertices, but there's no arrowhead on it. Okay. We talk about two types of graphs. One is an undirected graph. This has the property that it contains no oriented edge. The other one is a directed graph. This has the property that every edge has an orientation. Okay. We don't have any terminology for a mixed version, where you have some edges that are oriented and others that are not. Maybe you could call that a mixed graph, but really that's not standard terminology. Since the edge set is a set in the mathematical sense, you cannot have multiple occurrences of the same edge in a graph. Okay. In some applications, it's desirable to have two or three edges connect the same pair of vertices. In that case, we would refer to the resulting structure as a graph, as a multigraph, or a graph with multiple edges. Okay. All right, so here's an example of an undirected graph. Okay. Typically, we draw these rather than give you the sets. So in these nodes here, I've put vertex numbers. And in this case, I've started the numbering at 1. In some cases, people like to start the numbering at 0. Okay. So this is a graph that has 11 vertices or 11 nodes or 11 points. And then it has edges connecting pairs of points or pairs of vertices or pairs of nodes. None of the edges has an orientation. Therefore, this is an undirected graph. Okay. A directed graph. Again, I've got, in this case, 10 vertices. Sorry, this guy, I've got 11 vertices. So the vertices are numbered 1 through 11. Every edge has an orientation. Okay. Now let's look at some applications of graphs. One application is to the representation of a communication network. So for example, here, this graph here represents a communication network where the vertices represent, let's say, the cities in the network, and the edges represent communication links. So there's a communication link connecting vertex 6 and vertex 4. There's another link that connects 4 and 1, another one that connects 1 and 2, yet another one that connects 2 and 5. Okay, so I can take a communication network which involves cities and links and represent that as a graph, as shown in this example here. And then you could try and do interesting things like if you want to send, let's say, a message from 6 to 1, well, then you could use the link from 6 to 4 followed by the link from 4 to 1. Okay. All right, so one application to the representation of a communication network in which the vertices are cities, the edges are links. Here's another application. This is to the representation of cities and driving distances between pairs of cities. This kind of diagram is something you would see if you opened up an atlas, a road atlas such as the Rand McNally Atlas. You'll see a figure that looks like this. The vertices represent cities, and the edges represent the driving time or even possibly the driving distance between two cities. Okay. So if you want to go from drive from 6 to 4, maybe you have to spend 5 hours of driving time, or maybe this represents that it's a 50-mile distance or whatever the convention is. Okay. All right, so another application of graphs is to the representation of cities together with the driving time between pairs of cities. Okay, another application here is to representing street maps within a city. Okay, so in this case, each vertex may represent an intersection in the city, and the edge represents a road. Here, the edges are directed so that I can have one-way edges, or I can represent a one-way street. So this edge here says you can use this street from intersection 5 to get to intersection 3. Of course, you can't come back on that street to return. This thing here is like shorthand to show two edges. One is directed from 5 to 6, represented by that arrowhead. From 5 to 9. And then the other one, represented by this arrowhead, is directed from 9 to 5. Okay. So we often use double-headed edges to represent two edges, one in either direction. All right, so those are some of the applications. As we go through this class, we'll see other applications of graphs. The number of applications to which graphs have been put is literally in the thousands, so we don't expect to even scratch the surface of the applications that exist for graphs. You can find applications for graphs in virtually every discipline of study you might look into. Okay, now let's look at some properties of graphs that are useful in the analysis of algorithms that work on graphs. First, let's take a look at a complete undirected graph. All right, a complete undirected graph basically has all possible edges. Okay. If you have a graph that has one vertex, then a graph with one vertex cannot have an edge because an edge has to connect two different vertices. So this would be the complete graph with one vertex. Complete graph with two vertices can have only one edge because an edge must connect two different vertices, so that's the only possibility. Okay. A complete graph with three vertices has three edges connecting all three pairs of vertices you can get with three vertices. Okay. A complete graph with four vertices has six edges in it, corresponding to the six different pairs you can construct when you have four vertices. Okay. All right, now, useful in the analysis of algorithms that deal with undirected graphs is knowing what is the maximum number of edges you could possibly have in the graph. Okay, and so for that, we go through analysis of this form, which says, well, each edge is a pair of the form u, comma v, where u and v are different. Okay. And now we need to figure out how many such pairs can you have. Okay. For u, in an n-vertex graph, you can have any one of the n possible vertices. So you've got n choices for u, but once you make a choice for u, your choices for V are somewhat limited. You cannot use the same value for V as you used for U, so you only have n minus 1 choices for V. So the total number of pairs of this form you can construct, n choices for U followed by n minus 1 for V, so you get n times n minus 1 pairs. Okay. However, each pair does not represent a different edge because two pairs, UV and VU, represent the same edge. Therefore, in this count here, we need to make note of the fact that for every possible edge, it has been counted twice. And so I divide by 2 to end up with the actual count for the number of vertices. It's n times n minus 1 over 2. All right, so the number of edges in an undirected graph cannot exceed n times n minus 1 over 2. All right, turning my attention to a directed graph, okay, the analysis is very similar. The total number of pairs you can have is n times n minus 1. However, this time, the pair UV and the pair VU represent different edges, so I don't have to perform any adjustment on this expression here to arrive at the total number of edges. The number of edges, in fact, in a complete graph will be n times n minus 1, and in an arbitrary directed graph, it will not be more than n times n minus 1. Okay. So in both cases, the number of edges in a graph is order of n square, In an undirected graph, you can have up to n times n minus 1 over 2 edges. In a directed graph, you can have up to n times n minus 1 edges. Right, we'll talk about the degree of a vertex. This is simply the number of edges incident to that vertex. So if you look at our graph here, okay, vertex 2 has 2 edges incident to it, this one and that, so its degree is 2. Vertex 5 has 3 edges, 1, 2, 3, its degree is 3. And vertex 3 has a single edge incident to it, this one here, so its degree is 1. Now, if we were to add up all of the degrees, or if we were to add up the degrees of the edges, then we end up with a rather interesting quantity, which we'll see in a moment. Okay. So if I look at this graph here, okay, and you add up the degrees of the edges, we will end up with a quantity which is 2 times the number of edges. To see this, note that each edge contributes 1 to the degree of the vertex on this end and 1 to the degree of the vertex on the other end. Similarly, this edge contributes 1 to the degree of 8, 1 to the degree of 11. This one, 1 to the degree of 10, 1 to the degree of 11. Okay. So each edge contributes a count of 1 to the degree of 2 different vertices. As a result, if you were to add up all the degrees, you would end up with 2 times the number of edges in the graph. Right, this fact is important when we analyze algorithms. We'll see that their complexity is the sum of the degrees, and then we can replace the sum of the degrees by saying it is 2 times E. Okay. All right, performing a similar thing for directed graphs, here we talk about in degree and out degree rather than just the degree. By in degree, I mean the number of incoming edges. Okay. So if I were to look at this vertex here, the edge 1, 2 is incoming, whereas the edge 2, 5 is outgoing. Okay. So the in degree of vertex 2 is 1, there's only one edge coming into it. The in degree of vertex 8 is 0, there are no edges coming into it. Both these edges are going out. We can talk about the out degree of a vertex. This is just a count of the number of outbound, outgoing edges. Okay. If you look at vertex 2, there's one edge going out, the other one is coming in, so its out degree is 1. Look at vertex 8, there are 2 edges going out, its out degree is 2. Here too, we'll see an interesting property between the number of edges and the sum of the in and out degrees of vertices. Okay. Each directed edge contributes 1 to the in degree of a vertex and 1 to the out degree of a vertex. Therefore, if you were to add up all of the in degrees, you should get the number of edges in the graph. And if you were to add up all of the out degrees, you'd also get the number of edges in the graph. So in this case, the sum of the in degrees equals the sum of the out degrees equals the number of edges in the graph. Okay, so I guess that's just a collection of very basic properties for graphs. Hopefully none of what I said on graphs was new to you. You've seen that before. And next time when we meet, we're going to take a look at some problems people like to solve on graphs, and we also take a look at how graphs can be represented inside a computer. Okay. All right, for today we're going to stop out here. Thank you.